darkly splendid abodes, the official podcast of Toronto Thelema, exploring, if you will, practical philosophy, from science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Addressed by Crowley to his magical son Charles Stanfield Jones, better known as Fra Rakhad. It covers the gamut of the Thelemic perspective on pretty much everything, and as such is an indispensable guide and reference. We'll take a look at a set of chapters therein on the subject of the will.
Then it'd be like a base 80 system. But if it was a base 80 system, then it would have been 80 would be 100.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And I forget how I worked that out. But anyway, I think it was the wording, the particular wording in the diary where it says that he'd be 101. So, you know how, like, you know, people say, like, 86 or something like that?
Yeah, like 87 years ago is 87.
Yeah.
So the score is 20. And then what was it we were reading where it kept saying, like, 20? Oh, it's just the Pistis Sophia last month.
Yeah.
The 20th eighth year.
It's yeah, like, oh, it's a very British
thank
wave.
You very much.
Yeah. 20, okay. Yeah, so do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love and her will.
Welcome aboard.
Hey, it's good to be back on the good ship podcast.
On the good ship, darkly splendid abodes.
Yeah, sailing the dark seas. Splendid abodes.
Yeah.
Today you suggested we look at the Book of Wisdom or Folly, Liber Aleph Vel 111. Is that what that says?
Mm-hmm. Or if we wanted to say it in Latin, we could figure that out, but I'm not going to. Centum et undecim. Undecim et centum, probably. Maybe
okay.
That's where the British get it from, is doing like Latin where you say the...
every time you speak Latin from now on, you have to say probably.
Probably.
Punctuate it with the word probably. Those are your commas and periods.
Vel means or, incidentally. Probably.
Oh. Vel probably means or. So this is a fun book. I don't have as much experience with it. It's one of the in the Thelemic corpus that I have not spent a lot of time engaging. I think that I'm allergic to aphorisms. I don't like getting in and out too fast. I'm not like a toilet reader. Like, you know, it takes me 20 minutes to get grounded and focused.
Porcelain
and,
king.
And so, like, you know, and by the time I've done that, I, you know, 9 pages have gone by. So it's very helpful to do this. Someone was telling me that they felt like they had been a Thelemite for many years, but they confessed to me privately that they felt like that they had a little bit of imposter syndrome or something, because they weren't sure they were completely, you know, they didn't understand as much about the Crowley corpus as they felt they should after the amount of time they put in. You know, we get judgy with ourselves for no reason from time to time, right? Like, our investment is our investment, and we should all just be comfortable with this. You know, you strive to do better every day, or what the
fuck. We're all special snowflakes.
Yeah. So I said the cure for Thelemic imposter syndrome is magic without tears. You read this book 3 times, and not that you stop being an imposter, but you realize that everyone else is an imposter. Like,
when, there are once, no non-imposters.
Once you've read that book 3 times, you've read it more than about 97% of the people in the Thelemic community, and probably understand the Crowley's approach better than most of the leaders. So just sit down with it and go through it. And there's actually, Magic Without Tears is not the only solution. There's a couple of books like this. I think the magical and philosophical commentaries on the Book of the Law is like this. And where if you go through it carefully 3 or 4 times, you get a good understanding of Crowley's perspective in a snapshot from some period of his life that's going to be, and you're going to be better at thinking about some of this stuff than like 90% of the people in the mm-hmm. open quotes community, end quotes. And another one, although I can't say this with authority, because as I said, I'm somewhat distant from this text, but another one of these that I suspect is like this is LibreLF. If you have imposter syndrome, three or four good, careful passes through LibreLF should help clarify some issues for you.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I can corroborate that on authority because of having fully read it a few times. But it's one of those books that, like, it's been a while since I've really gone over it. Like, occasionally I'll go back to it and read a chapter or two. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of a shame not to have gone back to it more heavily, because I've always thought of this book as being kind of like an extended commentary on the Book of the Law.
Okay.
And the difficulty I think that it has is in the fact that Crowley put himself to a very austere form when writing it, which is, as you said, it's pithy. Each chapter is one page long and kind of done in an ornate sort of medieval fashion. So the language is very... you know, it just takes getting used to, and some of it can be a little bit more obscure. And it's a little bit difficult in the sense that I find, like, if you take one chapter, usually they don't exist in isolation. So you kind of have to read a few chapters at a go in order to get the full idea. And even then, you probably have to read through it a few times to be able to get really everything out of it, because there's so much packed into it. But on top of that, if you did just take one chapter, it's almost like he could say in two sentences what he's getting across in that chapter, maybe even one sentence, but he's flowered it into this sort of form that ends up meaning that it doesn't immediately come across necessarily. So I could see where this would be a much more opaque piece for a lot of people.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the elevated style, I think, is there's ways in which it's helpful and ways in which it's unhelpful, right? I mean, one maybe enjoys reading it more because the style is elevated, rather than if it were just like a basic kind of, you know, what do they write? They write newspapers to what, a fourth grade level, a sixth grade level, or mm-hmm. something like that, because that's the baseline literacy standard across the population. Most human beings only read at a sixth grade level.
Yeah.
And so getting a piece of what amounts to philosophical text that's at a sixth grade level, you know, is one possibility. But, you know, people throughout the history of philosophy have written all sorts of wacky styles, because I think one definition of philosophy is that we choose to approach problems that everyone agrees are important, but for which there's no reliable agreed upon standard for how to approach these problems. Mm-hmm. And as soon as a reliable agreed upon standard develops, then those disciplines break off from philosophy and become independent. So, you know, once you have tools for doing mathematics, mathematics becomes mathematics and stops being caught under the bucket of philosophy.
The bucket of philosophy.
Yeah. All these disciplines like crabs scattering across the beach. You're just dropping buckets from the sky trying to catch them in the bucket of philosophy.
Don't analyze that too closely.
And so, you know, it's a discipline that lends itself to many creative approaches, much to the chagrin of the modern academic system.
Nietzsche is a good example of, yeah.
Yeah, so working in and Crowley has himself taken a number of different approaches. Often his best philosophy is in the form of personal letters, like the Magic Without Tears is personal letters, and they're great. But this is supposedly a personal letter. It's an epistle to his magical son, you know, Frederick Had, who we've dreadfully dealt with a number of times on the test. but it doesn't read like a personal letter. It reads like you say, it's just shy of aphoristic, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as concise or pithy as, you know, like a one or two sentence aphorism, but it's kind of tending in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I propose to do, you suggested, I think, six or seven chapters of this,
mm-hmm.
is to just start reading rather than isolating little quotations from each chapter because the chapters are already so tight that I think it makes sense to kind of work through them in order. Mm-hmm. And if we don't get through all seven, we won't, but there'll be things to say about, you know, we'll three or four breaking places in each chapter where we'll have to stop and talk about it.
Yeah. And I guess what we could do is maybe set it up with one of the things that called me to take this particular series of chapters is the fact that we're looking at two main themes, the idea of sin in the Thelemic context. So as sort of put forth in the Book of the Law, the word of sin is restriction.
Good.
The next one is relativity within mainly the spheres of morality and generally speaking, saying that each individual will has its own sort of law, as he puts it in the language of these chapters, and each individual will also has its environment with which it interacts. So those are the two main things that I want to sort of bring to mind as we go through these.
Yeah, it starts in the moral realm and then kind of scales up to the metaphysical realm, because there's something called the discipline of art or something that is not only a sort of a guide for life, but also very quickly, without too much explanation, becomes the schema for why existence exists and the solution to the hard problem of evil for Crowley as well. So it starts very fine-grained and gets bigger quickly, and we'll see why that is. I think you initially suggested on starting on 196, and that's an answer to an objection and does start a sort of the thread that we're talking about here. But I thought we'd come back to 195. And can you read these chapter headings? Because my Latin pronunciation is going to be embarrassing.
Yeah. De arte voluptatis dilemma quaedam.
Probably.
Yeah, probably. I've got the version edited by Bill Breeze, and it's he includes the English underneath, which he gives as on a certain problem in the art of pleasure.
There is a named objection, O my son, to our thesis concerning will, that it should flow freely in its way. So that's the thesis, right? Will should flow freely in its way. So that what we're going to be discussing here over the next several pages is basically pure will and assuaged of purpose, delivered from the lust of result, is every way perfect. Mm-hmm. The word assuaged means something like dealt with, sorted out, you know, resolved, or like distracted from, like pushed away, like appeased. And so unassuaged means not those things, probably, right? Mm-hmm. So pure will, unassuaged of purpose, my interpretation is purposeful. Pure will filled with purpose, but delivered from the lust of result. So you are directed in a direction, but somehow without being goal-oriented. And so if you can accomplish this kind of going for the sake of going, this is the kind of movement that is in every way perfect. And so he says there's an objection here that for such as I am, it is well. So for Crowley, this is a good philosophy. Crowley's will should be unrestricted, because I am endowed by nature with a lust insatiable in every kind, so that the universe itself seems incapable to appease it. For I have poured myself out unceasingly in bodily passion and battles with men, with wild beasts, with mountains and deserts, in poetry and other writings, of magic, of mine imagination, and in books of our own mysteries, and in the works magical, arts plastic, and so forth. So that in mine age I am become verily a slave to my own genius. So these are like the categories in which this application of lust is possible. Lovemaking, adventuring, working, art making. And so the reason to list all these categories is to say that it's comprehensive. Pure will unassuaged of purpose and delivered from the list of results is every way perfect in all categories. Almost no matter what you're doing, you can apply this principle.
And I do like the fact that he says, I am become a slave to my own genius, because of the fact that he, throughout his writings, will occasionally reference genius as being an important key, where it's like he likes the idea of becoming sort of the servant of genius, where you as the human being are sort of like the secretary, as Simon If puts it in Moonchild, the secretary who's taking dictation from the genius.
It is my law that unless I sleep or create, my soul is sick, and fain to claim the reward and the recreation of my death. But I hear thee say, this is not the case for all, or even for many men. Their ort of will is satisfied easily at its first guerdon. And guerdon means something like goal or satisfaction or reward or something like that. So there's going to be, I think, three objections in this one named objection. And the first one is that if will is totally unrestricted, it's going to squib out. You know, most people, if they're free to do things, go and like happily do the thing and then just go and have tea, you know.
Nice middle class people.
Yeah. Yeah. Give it an unlimited supply of beautiful women. Most men would fuck one woman and then go and have tea. Or given, you know, you get a Lego kit and you're really excited to build a Lego kit and you follow all the instructions on the first page. You think, okay, this is a nice break. I'll come back to it tomorrow. And then you never come back to it. You know, you just, that if will is totally unrestricted, if there's no conflict or something, that most people just won't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is insightful, and we'll see in the next chapter how Crowley gets around it. But the idea that for Crowley, he's so internally motivated that even being born like as what we would now think of as like a trust fund kid with bottomless resources, he goes out into the world and, this is often a criticism, like frivolously blows through two separate fortunes just because he's got so much want in him and doesn't understand how money works. Like he sometimes literally thought he was paying for things with his signature. Like he didn't realize that there was an account somewhere tied to it. So this is one kind of objection. What do you think of this? Do you think that unrestricted man just gives up and doesn't do anything, or what?
Well, it's interesting to think how many of these, you know, charismatic billionaires or millionaires or whatever are just out there doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And people who end up like managing to get like a massive income who become successful. I was talking about some podcasters who ended up getting $100,000 a month or something when they started getting successful. And it's like, well, they didn't just stop.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't stop being, you know, doing stuff. They weren't able to do more stuff. So I would argue that obviously a certain aspect of it is going to be related to Crowley's personality and his inclinations and that sort of thing. But being uninhibited by monetary restraints and things like that, and just being ground down by having to work for most of your waking hours or something like that, it's going to enable you to do all kinds of things that you wouldn't do otherwise. That being said, there is something to be said for this sort of more commonly, people will tend, it seems on observation, to be pretty happy and content, you know, in general with a certain amount of facility. So like that middle class syndrome of just being, you know, I'm pretty happy with what I got here, you know, so I'm not striving for more.
Money is, at least in our culture, so much the kind of key to this, isn't it? The kind of energy that we're talking about is, there's a material element to it, this financial kind of flow through, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you have what seem to be unlimited resources, the world becomes a much more beautiful place where if you think like, oh, maybe, and Crowley is constantly putting himself in situations where money won't help him, right? Although he does have, you know, attendance and stuff, but like climbing, you know, climbing K2 the way it was done at the time, to have like porters and assistants and basically be bringing a small town up the side of the mountain with you rather than a taut little team of three or four the way it's done now, you know, having the money to fund that expedition is is essential, right? Like you can't fund that expedition without a thick pocketbook.
Yeah.
But then once you're up there, it's just you and the mountain and 400 Sherpas. And if there's a cave in or a landslide or something,
yeah,
you can't buy your way out of that. So, I think people of means sometimes will seek out these kinds of life experiences that are closed to people who don't have means. Challenges available to everyone, you know, people can challenge themselves, but you know, we're living in a world with a hierarchy of needs, and so if some of them aren't met, then you have enough challenges already without pushing yourself too far. So the second objection: also, there is what I have written in a former chapter on the right use of discipline. And so I went through this trying to find a chapter called On the Right Use of Discipline, and I didn't see it.
Not so much, yeah. So I'm guessing it's under a different title, and I wasn't sure myself, but there's a few places that could be contenders, I think.
We have to guess what he means by this, but I think given what we've read about Crowley up to this point, I think it's not hard to guess what he means by this, that it's probably something to do with... thou hast no right but to do thy will, do but that, and no other should say nay, right? How you apply yourself to the particular appropriate task and push yourself through it, right? You're still allowed to work hard. and you have to sort of block off extraneous concerns and not get distracted by things that aren't within the purview of your own personal will, right? There's all sorts of distractions. There's, you know, Lego kits and and video games and beautiful girls, to sort of call back to my earlier examples, but you should be doing that one thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so the part of the objection to free-flowing will is that, well, isn't this idea of right discipline, doesn't that count as a restriction, as an impediment to flow? And then the third objection: this free flowing is without subtlety of art, as it were, an harlot that plucks men by the sleeve. And so there's free verse, let's say. There's someone named, is her name Anne Hébert, who writes free verse in French prose, and a number of other people who have tried to do this kind of like, I don't mean free verse where it's totally unrestricted by like rhyme or meter, but I mean like prose that are like stream of consciousness prose, where you just sit down and you try to write in a character's perspective in the way that people think.
And totally Gonzo sounding.
There's still an element of craft about it, but the effect is supposed to be of one of craftlessness, where you're just experiencing the thoughts of the character as you go along. And so they can sub-reference and they can whip back and forth through time, because it's supposed to be representative of the way people, it's supposed to be representative of the main character's interiority.
Mm-hmm.
But even this requires craft, you know, because it's not your stream of consciousness. It's the stream of consciousness of the character you're trying to create. And you still have to like figure out a way for that to communicate the story you're trying to tell. So to be totally unrestricted, to have free flowing will, the third part of this objection is, well, how do we make rocket ships? Because totally free-flowing creativity doesn't allow us to, maybe, it doesn't allow us to nuance, finesse, edit, organize. Aren't these ideas of organizing and finessing and editing, aren't those restrictions? Like, isn't that a way to externally shape and perhaps hamper the will. So
maybe another example or another way of taking it is if you have if you're trying to direct an electrical current, mm-hmm. you would need the restriction of the proper insulations and whatnot.
Sure, and this is a very thelemic idea, right? And so pure will unassuaged of purpose and delivered from the lust of result, maybe a lightning bolt, you know, it just goes where it needs to go. It follows the electrical gradient, you know. But if you want to do anything, if you want to fill that with purpose, right, then some controls and directions need to be applied.
I also find that, like, the way that I was reading this and thinking about it in similar terms, it seemed to me that one of the things that he's getting at is the idea of creating tension to extrapolate the pleasure, the ecstasy, the experience itself.
Yeah, that's right. Do you want to read the next one, and then we'll pause when you feel like pausing?
Yeah,
and we'll
let's do that. So the next one is De hoc modo dissolutio, and Breeze gives it as an unraveling of this knot. I'm not sure that Breeze actually, I don't think he has Latin, so I think he had somebody help him with these as well.
But, how would you translate that?
De hoc modo dissolutio, this method of dissolving.
Okay.
Or freeing, yeah. So, here therefore will I write down the answer to this indictment of our wisdom, that every act of will is to be made in its perfection, which state is to be attained according to these conditions. First, those of its own law. Second, those of its environment. Judge thine own case individually, each as it pleadeth. For there is no canon or code, since every star hath its own law, diverse from every other.
Yeah, so let's pause there, because this is one of the themes you wanted to try to bring out, right?
Yeah.
And so, what do you want to say about it?
Context. Mm-hmm. Could sum it up in the term context. The more I think about these things and explore these subjects, the more I realize that context is the most simple word that you could reduce it to. It's any simplification is an oversimplification, I'm sure, but just giving it the term context kind of helps to get the idea across. I think this is one of the most fundamental things for Thelema, because we have such a second nature, maybe even first nature approach to living, where we think of things in terms of good and bad and blanket morality towards things and approaching things with that mentality, whereas within Thelema, when you become more attuned to the idea of context, then you get more and more loosened up from some of these anchoring and debilitating ideas. So I think it's really fundamental, and if you start reading the holy books with this in mind, it can be really helpful.
I think that if you're the best artist in your high school, you know, if you have a real aptitude for reading and understanding, and you're emotionally sensitive, and you're spontaneous, and you can take direction, you know, a lot of people might think that their true will is to be a movie star, you know, because you've got all the raw materials. They just need to be shaped, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're the best actor in your high school. So, like, you know, whatever. But if you're not a gorgeous 16-year-old living in California, and you don't have the financial means to move to California and start pounding the pavement, you are unlikely ever to become
a movie star.
And even then. So there's a way in which those aptitudes need to be applied to the immediate context, and you need to find the space in your own environment. Maybe it's join a Masonic lodge. You know, if you like memorizing text, they got text for you to memorize, you know? And so there's transferable skills in every discipline, and you need to find the place where you fit, because like, life is context dependent.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not a criticism. Like, if will flows freely, just like, say, water flows freely, it's not a criticism of the river that it follows the riverbed. You know, mm-hmm. that's sort of yeah, just what exactly. it does. You know?
And if the water's been stopped up, it's no business of some other river. Well, this might get a little bit cloudy, this analogy. But it's like, yeah, me trying to tell you what you should do, how you should govern yourself and that sort of thing. I don't know all the context of your where you're coming from and what's best for you.
Rivers scolding each other for going off course.
The bastards.
I'm not the one who built this dam here, man. Come on, I'm just a river. You need to pull your socks up.
Pull your socks up, river. Mixing metaphors now.
Yeah, that's the creek. You know, I grew up in Scarborough, and there was a creek near my house that was always just absolutely chock full of wet socks. I don't know what that's about.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Now, there's the restraint of conflict, which is impotence and disruption. But the restraint of discipline is a fortification of the will by repose and by preparation. As a conqueror resteth his armies and feedeth them and looketh to their furniture and their spirit before he joineth the battle.
Is he in bad faith here, or is he accusing the hypothetical interlocutor of being in bad faith? You know, like to say, like, oh, yeah, will should be unrestrained. It's like, well, what about self-discipline? Oh, self-discipline isn't a restraint. It's just, you know, it's, yeah, we're restraining ourselves, but like, for, well, that, yeah, you know.
This, when we start looking at this, it can, yeah, it initially seem very kind of like, well, is this kind of like over? Yeah, exactly. So I think like in this case, we'll start with the restraint of conflict.
This is confusing to me because I thought we loved conflict.
Yeah, exactly.
I thought we were pro-conflict.
But if you're, I think the idea being that conflict is to be overcome, and restraint of conflict, which is impotence and disruption. So it seems like he's taking it as conflict to the point where you are disabled. So,
yeah, so conflict as impotence makes it seem like we're talking about an internal conflict, right?
Oh, it could be external as well. I mean, if you're smaller, like if you're a kid mm-hmm. and you're in an abusive home situation, then you are, you know, you are going to be severely disabled by your environment.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. And so people living in these contexts where they're unable to fully, you know, express themselves, but I think Crowley would say that people who are sort of living in these contexts, there's one approach to this where you can think of people choosing their lives, you know, that where they have the appropriate level of challenge that they need to get over. You know, you're born into this context because your soul decided, which is in some places an explicitly Thelemic view, that, you know, you choose the life you are ready for. And, you know, people will talk about how the world has always been bad for women, for example, you know, like for, you know, 2000 years or plus of a patriarchal system where women are oppressed. But in every generation, there are female poets and female artists and female politicians, you know, maybe only two or three of them, but there are people that are able to overcome these, the broader sociological context because of their own specific context and because of their own, you know, genius, essentially, right? To rise to positions of prominence.
See, my problem when we get into this kind of territory is that it becomes a little bit too speculative and too in our heads about it. So, like, for instance, when people start imposing the idea of reincarnation, which does come up, thelemically speaking, although we don't really draw full conclusions about it. Like Crowley didn't specifically, he, you know, had the caveat that it doesn't really matter if you're looking back at previous lives and into previous lives, whether or not they really were you, or if it's just you able to address certain things about yourself through these processes. It doesn't ultimately matter as long as you get some kind of a result out of it. But when we get too into creating a schema for like how these things work, for instance, like you having chosen this life, the problem that I have with that is like, yeah, you might be right, might actually be something structurally built into Thelema, but I still think it's on the speculative end of things. If you are dealing with, again, it's like, okay, if we're talking about somebody in a given circumstance, for instance, a child who's in an abusive situation, I don't think it's my business to pass judgment on them and say something like, you know, they chose that life, so they, you know, that doesn't, it doesn't follow. And it's not my business to try and impose my views in that way. That's one of those cases where it's like the relativity of the thing ends up being thrown off and undermined by trying to create like a mental schema for that. So it seems like a rationalization that I would have a problem with.
Okay. I think that, yeah, well, I mean, it's just obviously true that children who grow up in abusive households have a harder time than children who don't grow up in abusive households, and that this sort of conflict, like it's a conflict is impotence here is the metaphor, that this sort of like family dynamic significantly impedes people's flourishing.
It can also provoke good results, you could argue, because like some people who are extremely successful talk about having a really tough time growing up and that sort of thing.
Right. And so there is this conversation that happens about whether or not, like, you know, our trials make us stronger and give us character, or whether, you know, imagine if this guy or if somebody is successful in spite of their troubles, and imagine how successful they'd be if they weren't in these problematic conditions. But I think for the reason I want to talk about it in terms of an internal conflict, the reason my inclination is that way, is because I think when people, even people in difficult circumstances, begin to take responsibility for themselves, that's the beginning of progress, right? Like if you are a child in this terrible situation, there's no one there to help you. Mm-hmm. You know, we have chosen the absolute bleakest possible hypothetical. We could have picked anything, but here we are.
Yeah.
If you are a child in this situation, there's no one there to help you. And taking some responsibility for yourself and trying to figure out how to get out of that situation, or who to ask for help, like that is on you. And then there's this internal conflict of like, do I have the courage to do this? What are the consequences if my dad finds out? You know, like, and so part of what's paralyzing is part of the impotence is the internal fear of like what's going to happen if it changes. And so for our audience, who are hopefully not 8-year-olds, because I said that thing about fucking beautiful trigger warning. But for our audience, people who are like trying to decide whether to keep resh 4 times a day and meditate or play Minecraft this morning, you know, the conflict that leads to impotence, the more you can see that as an internal conflict that you're managing yourself rather than something that's imposed from outside. Like I could say that I didn't do my thalamic practice yesterday because I've just started a new job and I was nervous about going to work and I just needed to focus on relaxing. But like, and so like, it's my boss's fault that I didn't meditate yesterday morning, or I just need to get over myself and do the practice and make sure that's incorporated into my day going forward. So
that's a very good point. I think that's kind of like on a good track, but it is kind of worth making the clarification there, because of the fact that, yeah, I think becoming a magician, counter to empowering you to be able to, you know, avoid the problems and stuff like that, is actually about taking responsibility for everything you experience. Ultimately, you are responsible for everything in one way or another, and some things you have no power to do anything about, but that's fine too. It's not about good or bad or anything like that either. On the other hand, I want to be careful, because it's easy for our minds to over-rationalize things where we do come up with spooky ideas about things concerning right and wrong, for instance. But like, for instance, just to take it to an extreme of something that's not in the thalamic world, but somebody had suggested, like, they believed that, for instance, people who get murdered or suffer, you know, terrible deaths and stuff like that, they suggested that in a previous life, maybe they had done it to somebody else and they deserved, you know, it's kind of like karma and that sort of thing. And it's like, when you start getting into speculation of that type, then it's a rationalization that's not really helpful. So
I think people feel offended by this. I think that it hurts people's feelings, and I think that I understand why, right? Because, for example, when you're doing sociology, nothing is ever the fault of an individual, right? You're looking at trends on a societal level, on a social level, on a cultural level. And so, you know, if large numbers of, say, one particular subsection of a population are experiencing poverty, then the question is, what's going on this broad cultural scale to impose poverty on this people? Or sort of like, how does this kind of the situation that's in front of us kind of fall out, right? And we can recognize systemic issues that create cultural problems. But then there's been this conversation that's happened in the last year or two about culturally enlightened therapy, you know, that when you go to your therapist, that if a therapist says like, you know, here's how are you going to fix your problems, you know, that there's somehow misunderstanding the sociological perspective that like, oh, because I'm a member of X group, it's going to be harder for me than other people to fix my problems because we're in a societal condition that's, you know, that I feel I stomped down by. So telling me that I need more tools to be able to sort myself out is dismissive of the political circumstances. And I, you know, it's hurtful for me that you think this is my fault and not the, you know, not because of, you know, whatever societal structure, right? In this field. And the truth is, it's always hurtful, no matter what subsection of society is, to be told that you need to take responsibility for your own problems. But when you're doing therapy, everything is always your fault.
Yeah.
You know,
Now, I want to clarify, though, I'm not saying that, like, the victim in this case who we're saying deserves it because of what X thing. I'm talking about the person who's talking this way. I'm talking about the speculator. And because the reason that they're speculating this way is to make it easier for themselves.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. And that's one of the reasons I have a problem with speculative ideas like this, where it's like, we're not actually dealing with reality. We're dealing with thought games. And when we get into those thought games, a lot of the time we're coming up with answers to them in order to satisfy ourselves. So that's sort of what I'm getting at, and I hope that gets across.
Yeah.
But and apologies if that's kind of taking us a little bit farther afield.
No, I think that's exactly what's going on in this section, right? I mean, people may have their own people have their aptitudes and their, you know, their aspirations, but they exist in context. And so the tools need to be applied within the context, I guess, even if that context is horrible.
And a lot of the time when we are coming up with like speculation about the way things work and that sort of thing, or we get locked into the ideas of good and evil and what people deserve and what people don't deserve and what we can take responsibility for and what we're not willing to take responsibility for, those are all things that kind of get ossified in ourselves because of like these speculative games that we play in order to make it easier on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I think there's a certain level of, like, okay, let's accept that we don't actually know. And in this case, we were talking about the restraint of conflict, which is impotence and disruption. And so maybe even conflict, maybe through discussing it this way, maybe we can talk about it as that accepting yourself as a victim or, you know, I shirk responsibility because it's this other situation that I'm made impotent by. Mm-hmm. Whereas overcoming the conflict does involve, taking responsibility. And it's not about right or wrong again. It's about like responsibility basically would mean confronting it as it is and dealing with finding the solution based on the situation and the context and that sort of thing. So that it's not like, you know, that solution could be any number of things, but it doesn't have to be like a Christian ethic, for instance.
And the restraint of discipline, it's interesting that he continues to use combat metaphors here. It's like a general feeding and resting his army before the big battle.
Yeah.
You know, it's so like if conflict is impotence, then why is discipline resting your army before a battle? Like, but that's weird. But I think what he's saying here is like, if I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to keep resh. I'm going to keep Resh. I'm going to do it 4 times a day, 6 days a week. And that's going to be my thing this whole quarter, like from equinox to solstice. I'm going to keep Resh and try to get disciplined about doing that. The, you know, is this really free will flowing freely? Like, what if one day I want to go to the movies and the movie, you know, starts at such a time that I'll be at the pictures over sunset? Well, I can't, I don't want to have to leave the movie to go to the bathroom, you know, because what if it's a really good part? So I just can't go to the movie. Like, how is that free will flowing freely? I'm excited to see the movie.
Yeah.
And he's going to say that this application of discipline is not actually an impediment to the pure will. It's a bolster that by catching a later picture or waiting till it comes out on video or realizing that movies aren't that important or something, you know, that this is, we drive ourselves to higher aspirations by setting goals and accomplishing them. And that this isn't in conflict with the idea of free will flowing freely, because our energy has to be unassuaged of purpose.
You know? Yeah, and also as we see this develop, I think it's like, yeah, some of the ways that we speculate on things, some of the ways that our minds work in engaging with things, mm-hmm. some of the ways that we do try to take responsibility for things and come up against conflicts and things, whether interior or exterior, by becoming disciplined, we retrain a lot of these things and reorient these things. So it's a gradual process and it's an ongoing process. But I mean, trying to learn the thelemic ethic and internalize it is not just sort of, oh, I get it, I'll do that.
And you might have questions about whether or not this is definitionally true, right? Like, if I really am free and unimpeded, and my energy must go forth and do, you know, do the thing that the energy does, is it really the case that applying discipline doesn't count as a restriction, right? Like what, like
that, I think it does,
but then,
count.
But then you're just, that's a semantic game. The point exactly. is, this is what he means.
Exactly. Right? And that's this kind of semantics that I'm kind of criticizing with the speculation thing. And I think he is actually defining it as a restriction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying restraint here to kind of sideline that. But he gets into the idea of using sin. And I think that's part of what he's talking about, is this idea of restriction and something. I mean, maybe there's a difference there, because when he starts talking about sin, it's a slightly different context from what we've got with discipline in this case. Now, moving on, we have also, there is the restraint of art, which includeth that other of discipline, and its nature is to adorn the will and to admire its strength and its beauty, and to enjoy its victory by anticipation and full confidence, not fearful of time that robbeth them that are ignorant concerning him, but how he is but mirage and illusion, incapable to besiege the fortress of the soul. And there, I mean, that passage is one of those examples that I would say is a little bit opaque when you're first reading it and that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, this is, so here's the problem. Here's why it takes a long time to understand what's being said here. He doesn't explain what the restraint of art is. Mm-hmm. He mentions it in this chapter and the next chapter, and he doesn't define it. And so you're reading this expecting him to explain what he means by the restraint of art, and he never does, so you think you're misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. But it's not in here.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that's confusing is he doesn't explain what he means by the idea that time is mirage and illusion, and that you are omnipotent and that your habitation is eternity. You know, you're expecting some, he just drops those bombs and then exits. And so we're lucky to have read other works of Crowley that explain these things, because if you're here in this place where you're doing the right thing, right? Like, if you're committing yourself to an act of will to do, you know, that okay, from today forward, I will express my liberty defined as, you know, these thelemic practices, or, defined as I got a job working 4 days a week at a pizza place. I'm moving out of my parents' house finally. You know, I'm 16 and my old man can't hit me anymore. Yeah. Like if you got to this place where you're doing this the right thing, then this is the right thing. And all the other things that happened in your life were preludes to this moment. So you needed those, you needed every single experience to get to this place of doing the right thing. And so like you might as well have planned it, you know, if this is the right moment, then every moment was the right moment. And you're the god of your own universe because you did the things you needed to do. You were in this context that put you here in this place to do this one thing now that is the right thing. Mm-hmm. So you might as well, like, whether you want to believe it or not, you might as well be all knowing and all powerful because this moment is so pure and correct that how could anything that led up to it possibly have been a mistake?
Yeah, and it's also worth mentioning that Crowley naturally, seemingly, throws all kinds of Kabbalistic ideas into his writing as well, and he's quite fond of this. So in this case, we have its nature, this restraint of art, is to adorn the will and to admire its strength. We could associate that with Gevura. And its beauty, we could associate that with Tifereth. And to enjoy its victory, we could associate that with Netzach. So we're gradually moving down from mm-hmm, Gevra. Mm-hmm. And by anticipation and full confidence, I don't know if maybe we can associate that with Hud somehow, maybe in the conceptualization faculty of Hud. Not fearful of time that robbeth them that are ignorant concerning him. And I'm guessing time in this case is associated with Yesod, but which is kind of like a lower level Bina in certain qualities, and talking about the mirage and illusion. So that illusion is the illusory nature of the moon, and Yesod is sort of where I'm drawing that parallel, really. But to besiege the fortress of the soul, so
you could say the fortress is the kingdom, right? Mm, like if you've got a walled city behind a keep or something like that, or in a keep or something like that.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, I guess the, in that sense, maybe we could posit that he's referring to these things because it's sort of like you can use the tree of life as the way that you're adorning the will. So you're aligning and harmonizing these different aspects of yourself as represented by the various Sephiroth.
You're a semi-famous jazz improviser. That's correct. You play the guitar.
Yeah.
Like the Django Reinhardt of the 21st century.
Yeah. I dropped it and made some noises this one time. Yeah.
So what do you think? What's your instinct? What does the restraint of art mean to you?
I think that's the thing. Yeah, it is difficult. It is very difficult here, but he does refer to the passage from the Book of the Law. Wisdom says, be strong, in the next chapter, that then canst thou bear more joy. Be not animal, refine thy rapture, and so forth. So I would say that my instinct for what he's getting at here is that, again, creating that tension so that it creates a more interesting and dynamic effect of your expression of your will. And it is, it's on that cusp where he's not explaining quite clearly enough, and it's kind of questionable whether or not he's already got an idea of like what kind of things you should be working towards are, but he's having a hard time justifying it. If we have this whole, you know, Thelemic ethic and whatnot.
My suspicion is that he's being much more literal than that, that the restraint of discipline means getting up at 6 o'clock every morning and committing yourself to writing 10 pages. And the restraint of art means choosing whether you're writing a comedy or a tragedy, like picking a form, picking a form and writing to the rules of that form. And that you're shaping your product according to the conventions of that product, right? Like that's how we get to space, right? If your true will is to send a rocket to Mars and establish a colony there, you need to understand things about thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. And so that's the restriction of art, is knowing your discipline well enough that you can both commit to it and, you know, paint outside the lines a little bit. Like what he says about Whistler a couple of months ago, we were reading something. He mentioned Whistler, who I looked it up last week. Not actually a very controversial painter in terms of breaking out of forms and smashing, you know, smashing conventions. I wonder who he meant. He must have meant someone doing much more abstract work than Whistler was doing. Whistler's thing was like art for the sake of art rather than art for political or social motives. But he says, you know, it turns out Whistler used all the same rules that he was supposedly breaking, you know, like even if you want to destroy painting, you still have to use light and shadow. And so I think the restraint of art means what, you know, I was the joke about jazz improv, right? Like there's nothing wilder than free jazz improv. But and it's hard work to get to free jazz improv, right? Like, because if you're not in a key or in time, then what's, like it's a whole process. It takes a community of musicians years to figure out how free jazz works, and then more years to figure out how to, like they say, free the drummer so that the drummer can play.
And even just like basic jazz, like the idea of like being able to play in constantly changing scales and whatnot. The way that you do that is not by having to micromanage with that part of your brain that's constantly thinking all the time. It has to be laid in. All these ideas have to be laid in under the surface where it becomes conversational. If I'm talking to you right now conversationally, I don't have to think about vocabulary and grammar and that sort of thing.
Oh, shit, that's so good, man. Because I was talking about, you know, knowing the structure well enough to be within it and then to break it. But then once you know the structure, it gets in past knowing and becomes part of your... I always get this wrong. Instincts versus intuitions. It becomes part of your intuition, and then you flow naturally within that structure such that it's hard to break it, and your will is free. You just go for it. People who do, you know, not jazz improvisation necessarily, although I'm sure that's applicable too, but like, let's think about heavy metal improvisation where you're playing a metal solo that has to be in the box. Like you don't want to do too many dissonant notes. And it's technically proficient, but you can just do it. And because you know, because not that you know all the rules, but it's all ingrained. It's all in your fingers.
It's the language that you've been speaking, you know, for so many years that you're not conscious of speaking it anymore.
And so the restraint of discipline is the discipline to practice every day. And the restraint of art is because you practice, you know those forms, and then they get into you, and then you can just go for it.
And he caps things off with a reference to let this be for it is an heirloom and a ring of ruby and emerald in thine inheritance. And if we go back to Kabbalistic ideas, ruby we could again think of as Gevura, but like in the sense of will, and emerald as Netzach and love.
But so this the ring of emerald, he means this knowledge that you're all knowing and omnipotent. Those are the rings of ruby and emerald.
Explain, what do you mean?
So, well, that's what he says here. He says, thy will, knowing thyself omnipotent and thy habitation eternal, my son, attend well this word, for it is an heirloom, the ring of ruby and emerald. So somehow this thing about being, so these restraints are not just the restraints of whatever discipline you're practicing. You're not just learning to play jazz. It's sort of your whole life, right? Your whole life is the restriction imposed. It's the form, the context in which your being has flourishing.
It's love under will.
And so that context is, you're supposed to think of it as being, as yourself creating your own context all the time for the purpose of getting to this one place of where you can begin to express your flourishing and then continuing to,
and
to express
the fact that the knowing thyself omnipotent in thy habitation eternity frees you up from feeling like, there's an end point to this or something. Yeah, so it's not like you achieve this, because I think that's the normal thing, is you think, okay, I'm going to work and work and work, and then I'll achieve this thing, and that's the finish line. But instead, it's like, okay, this frees you up to realize, no, you're going to work and work and work and enjoy the ecstasy of that working perpetually.
Yeah.
which is a really nice aspect.
Subtler than the serpent of Hermes, O my son, is the way of the restraint of art, and thou shalt meet therein with the great god Pan and have him to thy playmate. Pan in the Thelemic pantheon is a god that lives kind of in either in the abyss or up in Binah, like the master of the temple kind of thing, the knight of Pan. Crowley talks a lot about Pan in the Book of Lies, which was written in anticipation. He was an Adeptus Exemptus writing that book, so in anticipation of crossing the abyss. And it's the Greek word that means all and everything. So somehow there's something like this master of the temple work of becoming adept with samadhi, of becoming a person who can, you know, make samadhi on any object at any time for as long as necessary and then come back, is wrapped up in the rules of art. So there's some neat way in which burrowing down and down and down and down into the rules of some discipline. Let's keep talking about improvisation, musical improvisation, that the more nuanced and careful and natural your technique becomes, you're burrowing down into one discipline, but the bottom of that hole is the great god Pan, is all, is the infinite. And I think this is maybe related to the way people talk about flow states or something like that, that by getting down into it, you hit this place of non-consciousness where you're just going and you have your first, maybe one of your first encounters with this big mind. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, the idea of the flow state always brings to mind like the experience of channeling. It feels like artists commonly express it as channeling. So that learning of the rules and everything, but imprinting them so deeply that it's almost like you become this channel that's focused in a particular way by all that discipline, and then that thing flows through you, which kind of goes part and parcel, I think, with the way that Crowley talks about genius. So it's like becoming a better vessel to channel that genius, and the way that you channel it is colored by the way that you discipline, the way that your discipline takes form and that sort of thing.
We're now in chapter, by the way, De Comedia Quae Pan Dicatur, probably?
Mm-hmm.
197?
The comedy that is called Pan.
And, I see. So shalt thou devise comedy and tragedy, as it were settings for jewels of thy will, to enhance the beauty thereof and refine thy pleasures. This is that which it is written in the book of the law. Wisdom says, be strong, thence can thou bear more joy. Be not animal, refine thy rapture. If thou drink, drink by the 80 to 90 rules of art. If thou love, exceed by delicacy. And if thou do aught joyous, let there be subtlety therein, but exceed, exceed. Thus thou mayest even toy with thy tame devil of sin, and use the pain thereof to sharpen the taste of thy meat. Being adult, thy tongue is keen to the olive, and cloyed by sweet, while a child is the opposite to this in his preferences. Or so a skilled match of love aboundeth in pinchings, slappings, bitings, and the like, to intensify the bout and to prolong it. But this is the risk and peril, unless thou be wholly master, one in thy will, for there is poison in these dead snakes to destroy thee if thou lend them thy life by so little as one doubt of thyself as a seed of division. So what does that mean? We covered this in one of our very first episodes on Liber 150.
Mm-hmm. Liber Libellum.
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways of looking at this. Let's do the most obvious one first. Tamed something of thy sin. What does it mean? Tamed devils
devil
of thy
of your sin. Yeah.
In Liber Libellum, he talks about this discipline, about redisciplining yourself and being consistent and eliminating distractions and stuff like this and overcoming. But then says, you know, once your devils are tamed, then you can enjoy them or not, depending on your whim.
Mm-hmm.
But until your devils are tamed, you have to kind of you know, be disciplined about them so that they don't overwhelm you. Crowley is so good on this theory of addiction stuff because he was an addict so many times in his life, yeah. And he's such a copious journalist. He just, anytime he's writing about the theory of addiction, he's so on top of his shit. Mm-hmm. And there's poison in these dead snakes, right? You can't be divided. So like if you're an alcoholic and you go to a Christmas party and everyone's loaded and, you know, you just want to like be there with the group, there should be no reason that you can't get drunk that night like everyone else and fully express, you know, like we were talking about earlier this season with, you know, the party, you know, the beauty of the party, the ecstatic, you know, losing mm-hmm. yourself in the party, and then go home and then that's it. But if there's like any conflict in you at all, you know, this is what the AA means when they say like, you know, no matter, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, right? Like they don't believe in, they don't really believe in recovery.
And you're
they
talking believe about Alcoholics recovery. Anonymous
yeah.
at this
not,
point.
Not, yeah. yeah, not sorry, not the Astrum Argentum. Alcoholics Anonymous, they don't let people ever think of themselves as recovered. Everyone is recovering, even if they have their 25-year chip, because Crowley's right. There's this danger where if for the sake of your art, you know, for whatever that is, you know, let's say you're doing a movie and you need to smoke, you know, even if you're smoking clove cigarettes, the gestures might remind you, you know, mm-hmm. Or something.
Yeah.
That you should be able to, as a master of yourself, choose to do these things or not, and that there can be an artistry in that. That can be that can be part of it. But this feeling of disgust of giving yourself to a vice, that's like spicing food. you know, it's not sugar. It's sort of like we talked about life being like kind of bittersweet, right? Like everything is bittersweet because we're adults, and so like sometimes we like olives more than candy floss. But it's important to have this kind of nuanced emotional approach where we let ourselves dip our toes in our vices and our horrors and experience the full range of human emotions, even including maybe feeling bad about ourselves sometimes, but that if we're going to do this, we need to make sure we really have conquered those vices so that we don't just become heroin addicts again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And also taking a look at it as the idea of the word of sin is restriction, and the following verse of like, let it be that state of manyhood bound and loathing. So with thy all that thou hast no right, but to do thy will. So the idea being that like it's a very thelemic thing to increasingly add to yourself and to expand your idea of self and eventually recognize that you are coterminous with the universe in a sense. And whereas this idea of sin being restriction, it's like we're using this in order to use what we think of as separation as being a sin, and a restriction particularly as being a sin. And we're using this to spice our life with. But there is the danger of seeing yourself as overtly separate from other things. And that can lead you down a painful rabbit hole in quite a bit of ways. So I think that's part of the conceptualization as well.
Yeah. I mean, we've been talking here a lot about the ways in which life is sometimes painful, more or less for other people as well, right? You know, and talking about personal vices and stuff like that is one angle, but using the pain of your life to color your artwork without letting yourself be overwhelmed by it. There's something else here where, like, even after you attain the realization of your own omnipotence or something like that, your own perfect power and the fact that you're, you know, the master of your own destiny or whatever, there's a way in which allowing yourself to sort of get sucked back into a more restricted viewpoint, you know?
If you can keep in touch with that part that is connected to everything
It's such a human, there's so many real human feelings in that, right? In feeling like you're a slave to your own circumstances, right? That it, that, that there's a way in which the artistic, an artistic expression without that sort of fatalism is missing a big part of what is the human experience for a lot of people. So sort of allowing yourself to not be fully transcendent 100% of the time, you know, it's this sort of pain is part of the spice, you know, somehow.
Well,
the
salt
that makes life.
Yeah. Going back to Liber Lavellum, where he's talking about the idea of discipline and whatnot. He's also using the metaphor of if somebody was watching a stage play, their level of engagement will kind of tell you, like, if they're noticing things going on around them and that sort of thing, that tells you what their level of engagement is in the play. So whether they're fully invested, they wouldn't notice. If they were fully invested, they wouldn't notice these other things going on in the audience or whatnot, but they would if they're distracted by laughing about people in the audience or, you know, looking at the time or, you know, wanting to go do something else, then they're clearly not invested. So if we think of it that way, it's sort of like if you think of your personal mundane existence as this stage play that you're invested in, then that might be kind of a fun angle of approach to take a look at it at.
His main metaphor here is think of it like incorporating a little bit of roughhousing into your lovemaking, right? Mm-hmm. That he says it both intensifies the bout and prolongs it. So, you know, going to a monastery and just sitting quietly under a lotus tree, under, you know, under the Bodhi tree or something like that. I don't think lotuses grow on trees. sitting quietly under elm tree, that gets you maybe quicker than anything else to this yogic attainment. But it isn't the same thing as living a life, you know. Mm-hmm. So once you attain that sainthood, it's virtuous, not like as a self-admonishment the way like, or like as a service the way other religions might think of it. You know, you go out and you go out and teach. You like humble yourself and go out and teach to help other people. It's like for you. It's one, you know, you go out into the world and experience it from your new perspective, including all its hardships and everything else. Mm-hmm. That it's both a gift to the world and to you. You know, what's this? Every time I try to say this word on the podcast, what's the when you attain Buddhahood but you choose not to accept it and you come back and teach
fearless Bodhisattva.
Bodhisattva, yeah. So you're not a Bodhisattva. It's not like, oh, you know, I wasn't selfish enough to claim my attainment. I had to come back here and humble myself and work for the salvation of all beings. You know, it's not a selfless act. You go out into the world because you want to be part of it, you know? Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I think I found for myself, like, one of the reasons that I like to do things that seem like I'm, you know, I could parse it to myself, like, oh, I want to do this to help other people and that sort of thing. But I sort of see it as ultimately selfish because I would prefer to be in a world, for instance, where people have some of these ideas in their lives, where they're acting on some of these ideas and that sort of thing. And yeah, seeing increasingly more of the world as an extension of yourself.
I mean, we've talked about this before, about like not caring whether or not anyone listens to the cast. I mean, the fact is there's no way I'd spend 4 hours, sorry, 2 hours talking about 4 pages of this book by myself.
Yeah.
You know,
if it was selfish in that sense, yeah.
My thelema improves by getting to have these conversations with you. And if that means we need to record them in order to motivate ourselves to do it, so be it, right? So it's a purely selfish activity. And then if people want to give us money, that's fine. You know, that can be their selfish activity. they can give us money for their own sake as well. Do you want to read the next one?
Following on from there, we have De Ludo Amoris, which means the play of love or the game of love.
Ooh.
In this mystery of the restraint of art is also the secret of illusion. Why, sayest thou, hath not our Lady Nuith her will of her Lord Hadith, and he of her, and so all ended? But this is the play of her love, that she veileth her beauty in the robe of illusion many-colored, and evadeth him in sport, yea, and divorceth him from the embrace, weaving new modesties and allurements in her dance. So that's kind of a fun idea. The basic conception, just to sum it up, is Nuit and Hadith extended from each other, and when they're united, they are, everything is nothing. Mm-hmm. And then when they're pulled apart from each other, that's where existence comes from. So it's the tension of their separation that creates existence in a sense. And so why don't they just fucking get it, loosen up the tension a little bit? Well, they do, but this is an interaction, a constant ongoing flirtation and interaction and concourse and intercourse that's going on. And this is the explanation for the nature of illusion and the nature of suffering along with it. Why should there be suffering? Well, suffering is an illusion caused by misunderstanding. Why is illusion? Well, because it is the allurement, the interplay of Hadith and Nuit, and it helps to spice their interactions. Now, O my son, the full comprehension of this arcanum is the fruit of contemplation. So you got to really think about this one. If this be prepared by the experience of this art to thine own case. But to them that understand not and have grief of separation, being deceived by this play, so that they deem it the division of hate, she can but speak in simplicity by that word written in the book of the law, to me. So that's interesting.
So this is getting into the speculative territory that you've earlier said you didn't want to get into, but now it's in the text, so we have to.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to talk about now with only this one chapter read, but he's going to kind of open it up in the next couple pages. That usually philosophers who talk about this stuff are like monists, right? They think, oh God, omnipotent God created the universe, and what explains pain, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this question of like, and they have various explanations for this, you know, like there's the devil, but then Crowley will say, you know, where did the,
yeah,
you know,
if the devil where is the illusion, devil come from? Then illusion is the devil, and yeah, where is?
Yeah, and how is it rational to say that we live in an illusionary world if it's created by, you know, all the explanations for...
It creates flaws to the idea of God in the first place. You can't get away with just saying it's all God, because then it will calls into question why God is omnipotent, but yet...
But we have in Thelema these two gods who are both sort of equally powerful, and they're not at war, but they are in love, and so the universe is they're like courtship dance, and just like, you know, we were talking about slapping and biting and pinching earlier, the tension of existence is there, kind of slapping and biting and pinching. How is this useful? Like, you know, it gives us a metaphysics that explains evil and suffering as being just like part of the play of the universe. But some suffering is horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not necessarily serving any purpose except, you know,
and
just
so
suffering.
So if this is just the game of these two ideal lovers that like creates, I don't want to keep going back to this same example, but it's, you know, it's what's in the music of the episode now. So it is what gives us these like abused children living in terrible circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, that doesn't make God a more sympathetic character than to say that like, that, you know, he accidentally created a devil. How could he have an accident? Or, you know,
yeah,
you know, and if you're not predisposed to theism, then it's not even a more believable picture. Like, it's a more believable picture because maybe it explains what we see, right? It's we don't have to say like, oh, you know, how could a good God create bad evil? We say, no, no, there's these two lovers who love dynamic tension. Mm-hmm. And so that creates what we perceive to be evil. But
it's still a rationalization.
But it's just another story. Like, yeah. Does that make us, just because it better explains what we actually see, does that mean we believe it? You know?
Yeah, and I'd say, like, the important takeaway in my mind is the idea of, again, being able to see beyond, like, when we think of things as being separate from ourselves, a lot of the suffering comes from that. And this is one of the things that's common for these other religious points of view as well that he talks about, the idea that the word of sin is restriction, meaning we are, when we restrict ourselves or when we are restricted or there is restriction, that makes things seem separate and not part of the same whole. And so, like, when we become in that state of separateness, if we take that as being like the position of hate that is referred to here, for instance, if this play seems to be the division of hate, she says to me, that's the only thing she can say in simplicity. The idea being that if you can return back to that state of all things being somehow not separated, then it seems to be more about a doctrine of the state of mind and the state of mind that you take in your approach to living. And so it's a little bit like thinking of it in hard and discrete ideas of like, well, there's Nuit over here and there's Hadid over here. And, I feel like it's more important your state of mind and how it is interacting with its reality. So, for instance, just to throw this out there, I did a talk recently that I had recorded. I'm going to post that somehow or other, whether on the podcast or not. And one of the ideas I put forth was something I'd parsed for myself about when I was learning Latin originally, and as a result, I started reading up on the ancient Romans and whatnot, and learning a lot of the history there. And for some reason, I had a natural distaste for the Romans and some like a natural hatred, as if like somehow my background goes to ancient Gaul or the Celtics or something, and like I had some kind of resentment towards the ancient Romans on account of that. And I don't know where that came from, but it's like just one of those childish kinds of things. I have no beef with the Romans directly because they've been gone for so long. But as I went on learning and all this sort of thing, I gradually started to get a picture in my head that it was actually culturally instilled by Christianity, this and like Judaism and that sort of thing, this resentment towards the Romans, which was even in ancient Rome itself, once it was taken over by Christianity, it was always kind of inculcated there towards the pagans and whatnot. So
you should do a DNA test. You look like you could have some Gaul in you.
But yes.
Do you have a little Gaul in you?
Do you not want at the some? Moment. Yeah, exactly. But my point was that I parsed it to myself by saying when I was originally had a distaste towards the Romans for some reason, I saw it as like learning about them and engaging with the culture, engaging with the language and everything was I parsed it to myself as eating the heart of the enemy. And as I ate the heart of the enemy, it became a part of myself. In kind of a similar way we were talking about the discipline thing. It's like internalizing something so that it becomes a part of yourself. And then the enemy part disappeared. And Crowley talks about this as well. Even like there was references that I made to places where he actually quotes things attributed to Jesus, like in the idea of love thy enemy. Mm-hmm. And the idea of, he says, Crowley, that love thy enemy is actually the first corollary of Thelema. And I think that's why, because it's the idea that when we think of an enemy that we want to hurt and that we keep separate from ourselves, it is separate, and that's a hate-related sort of thing that is only hurting ourselves ultimately. So if we instead eat the heart of the enemy in the sense of making it a part of ourselves, it feels like we're threatened by that, and that'll somehow cause us harm or compromise ourselves. But the reality is, no, it actually doesn't. I'll sometimes read up on Christian sort of subjects and whatnot, re-engage with Christian-related things. And, you know, occasionally I'll sort of worry about how that colors my thinking or how it'll affect me. It never threatens me in any way, ultimately. Mm-hmm. It actually ends up really reasserting strongly my complete commitment to Thelema, because Thelema just becomes stronger and stronger as an outlook on reality compared to any other perspective, particularly something like Christianity.
Well, how's this? I was sort of thinking about this in terms of how it affects our faith position, right? Like, like it's just another story. Like, do we believe this story more than the other one just because it like explains one or two more things? But like, I'm forgetting my own rhetoric here because Nuit is everything, right? And we know there is everything.
Yeah.
And Hadith is the infinitesimally small point of perspective.
Yeah.
And we know we have perspective.
Yeah.
And so
the flame in every heart of man and the core of every star.
And so if our perspective, our microcosm and our macrocosm, you know, we're living in this world where the world is my lover and sometimes it gives me a little spanking or something just to spice things up.
You won't be ultimately affected by that in the long run. It's hard to believe that when you're
so many jokes. I can't. 404. Seeing this interplay of the self with the world as, you know, all these little knocks and jostles as acts of love, as love play. This is the way that this follows on from the last chapter, right? Like he's talking about artistic discipline and then somehow steps up to metaphysics and like what? But the metaphysical picture I forgot is self, not self.
Yeah.
And so it very easily steps up to metaphysics, because if you're seeing yourself as the architect of your own universe and that there is no God but man and that everything in my life I did on purpose so that I could get to this moment where I was realizing that I was doing it on purpose, then like, of course, this is the interplay of Nuit and Hadith, myself and my world.
Mm-hmm.
And that this picture of suffering as being just like the natural consequence of that romantic relationship where, you know, sometimes things are a little harder and sometimes things are a little easier and we're moving through life and enjoying it. It's not actually a development. It's like the same idea.
Yeah.
Right. It's just slightly expanding the perspective to be inclusive.
Yeah.
And somewhere later on, he's going to say, you know, not to worry about this interplay from the perspective of other people. Unless it's specifically your will, you know,
you're talking to
go forth and do this healing work, you should focus on your relationship with the all spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. And not, yeah, as he puts it, pull on the reins of tighteneth the rein of the upon the stallions of the universe.
Yeah. You don't bridle the chariot, right? We might bridle the chariot. The master of the temple doesn't bridle the chariot. He just enjoys the speed of the horses. Just sit back and let the aimless winging, right? From Libra 65.
Yeah. Even though you have the crazy little boy of the rational mind trying to ask questions about why and
I've gone somewhat beyond the scope of the chapter that's in front of us because I thought it was important to get some of this stuff out.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid we're going to run out of time. What else from this chapter?
I guess I'll speed through the rest of it here. For until thou love, the play of love is but emptiness, and its cruelty is cruel indeed. Except thou know it to be but a sauce to whet the appetite. And as they say, since ancient times, hunger is the best sauce or the best spice.
Mm.
And to give emphasis of contrast, as a painter limneth the light by cunning of his shadows. but all this delight that thou mayest have of the universe, both in its veils and in its nakedness, is a reward of thine attainment of truth, and followeth after it. Nor canst thou comprehend this doctrine by mind, for the division in thee crieth aloud in its agony, denying it, unless thou be wholly initiate. So that's important. We need to continuously work towards initiation in order to get the most out of this. So you can't just know it intellectually and then say like, oh no, I'm not suffering.
Until thou love, the play of love is but emptiness, and cruelty is cruel indeed. So like, I guess it's up to every individual to find that perspective somewhere.
Yeah. I think you might remember me lamenting that I didn't understand love back in the day. And I think this is where it came from, was trying to find a right relationship to the idea of love, or to understand it better than most people tend to do when they're just going through their mundane lives and assuming that they know what love is because there's a cultural sort of understanding that's implicit.
I don't know if I remember you saying you didn't understand love. I think I remember you saying...
I usually follow it up with, baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
I think I remember you saying you didn't understand what people were getting out of romantic relationships.
Oh, maybe that's how you understood it, but yeah.
I'm sympathetic to that, I think. one does wonder. I sort of said that that friendship is the only thing where there's a net loss. Every friend you have, every interaction is a net loss. You know, for every joke your friend tells you, or every like lively conversation about the fucking X-Men or whatever, you have to hear two times about his wife. Or like, you know, like everything else, there's a little graph and there's hills and valleys, and in friendship, the valleys are always deeper than the hills are tall.
So you're saying the mean is just a steady decline.
Yeah, it's a steady decline. But if you don't have any friends, your life is way worse.
Yeah.
So friendship is the only thing where there's a net negative outcome. But and so you say like, oh, maybe I divest from that stock. And then you're just miserable. Like without those net losses month to month, life just isn't worth living. And so, yeah, it's very difficult to understand.
Well, even that, like,
human
I think,
what the value of human relationships is, but they do have value.
Yeah. And I think it's important to find how they have value for you as an individual as well. Because again, going back to the idea that every star has its own law and its own environment in which it works, so the context is different. So like, I think that was part of my issue when it came to relationships, was trying to understand my relationship to relationships and why, you know, basically it's different than other people, I think, and I had to find what it was in its own special snowflake way. To go back to that metaphor,
there's a couple more chapters we had on the list to do today, which is mainly Crowley kvetching about other philosophers and their approach to evil and how much better his approach to evil is. You know, if you see evil as the interplay of like two spirits in love, and that they just, you know, there's a romantic jostling that takes place, and sadness, sorrow, pain is the fallout from that. And there's some contrast of being versus becoming, which, and I think it's okay that we're not covering those because we're not actually equipped to cover them. He's glancing very quickly through a lot of different philosophical ideas that it would be nice to be able to say, oh, Nietzsche thought this, Hegel thought that, you know, whatever, you know, that he's summarizing a lot of stuff without footnoting it or whatever. So it's okay to miss that out, but I would encourage listeners that we had basically planned to read through almost to the end of the book, and the next, say, 4 or 5 chapters on from where we left off, he's continuing to defend this perspective that, you know, this metaphysics of Nuit Hadit, which for our purposes, let's say it means self, not self-dualism, and how that's a love story, and how thinking of it as a love story, you know. Here's other ways to think of it that might be in conflict with my picture, and they're just obviously corrupt. Yeah. And he calls them meso-philosophers at some point.
Meso-philosophers, yeah.
Meso like, means like haters of philosophy.
Yeah, it wouldn't be meso-philosophers because that'd be like haters of love.
Meso-sophists. Yeah. Meso-sophists. Haters of philosophy.
Haters of wisdom.
Of wisdom, yeah. So this polemical stuff is fun to read, but...
And I do like the way that he caps it with the idea of, so we were going to get to Zeta Tau, which is 203, and it's De aphorismo ubi dico omnia sunt, and that means on the aphorism whereby I say all things are, and it's pretty much getting across the idea that everything exists, everything that can be thought or can't be thought exists and has some kind of existence, and it's really just a matter of the way in which it interacts with its environment and that sort of thing in the language that it communicates to its surroundings with. So you may be totally blind, and to you color doesn't seem to exist, but it doesn't mean that color doesn't exist.
You're right, that is important. Okay, so after trash talking a bunch of philosophers and saying how their perspective on evil is nonsensical, he's going to talk about the illusion of Maya, which we've talked about a little bit on the cast before, and then also this Gnostic perspective that the world is a sort of a bad creation or something like that. Somehow, you know, our experience is illusory, right? Mm-hmm. And Crowley wants you to read German idealists like Berkeley and Kant and sort of see this argument for how we can't trust our senses, we don't really know what's out there, or for Berkeley, ideas are objects. All objects are ideas, but ideas really are objects, right? Mm-hmm. And so everything is mind. But he doesn't see he's clarifying that he doesn't see the world as false and illusionary. And he goes to dreams like Descartes does, although Descartes says, obviously the world is not a dream. Crowley says, well, dreams aren't real, but they have their reality in terms of how they impress our consciousness. And then, you know, all the things we see are just, and everything we can imagine is just imagined because it's a reflection of something we've seen. So, you know, there's this, he talks about this sort of like possible worlds theory where you know, there are things that are possible and what, you know, what sort of things could exist. So he's sort of like building up to this idea that everything has its own kind of reality in terms of, in its own special domain. And so nothing is an illusion. We're not living in a false world that doesn't exist. Like it's not nomina versus phenomena, mm-hmm. The way Kant thinks or Maya the way, you know, the Hindus think, or an evil demon the way Descartes kind of imagines. It's our world that we exist in versus our perspective on that world. And so it has a kind of reality mm-hmm. that's good enough.
And the context is all. Yeah. And this goes back to when we had the idea of mixing the planes coming up. So like treating the dream world the same way as you treat your, you know, trying to get from A to B in the what we call the real world, the waking world, then that's mixing the planes. Because if you were trying to fly across the street, you're not going to have much luck.
Maybe the best way to say it is like everything has a reality that's appropriate to its own context.
Yeah, a contextual reality. Yeah.
And so when we talk about, you know, oh, it was just a dream, or like, or if we try to write off the, oh, this is just the world of phenomena, mm-hmm. or another one that people think is, oh, it's socially constructed, so it doesn't matter, you know? It's like money's just only has value because we all agree that it does, you know? Yeah. Like, well, it's meaningless. Money doesn't matter. It's like, well, it is socially constructed, but it also obviously matters. Yeah.
The yellow lines in the road are a social construct.
Yeah, they're so, yeah, but but also vital.
Yeah.
So we live in this world of these constructed realities that are by no means less realities just because we've constructed them. And this scales all the way up to like spooky shit like Nuit and Hadit and Rahorquit and, you know, and
things
the
that
angels
exist
and demons that
the,
we encounter.
Yeah, things that exist on the light spectrum that we don't have access to, you know.
They have their reality in their own context, which is reality to at least to the equivalent degree of, you know, you're sitting in front of me here, the appeal to my senses and my consciousness. And
yeah. So it may not have relevance to us, but it still has reality.
Yeah. And you know what? It's important and it's covered in the pages we agreed to talk about, but we've read clearer arguments for this same line of thinking before in the last in the last several months. So I think we're good. I think we've done it.
Yeah. I mean, we did half of it at least anyway. Yeah. But yeah, this is a definitely read Lieber Leff. It's like I say, I think it's an extended commentary on the Book of the Law and an extended commentary on Thelema in general. You can't really get much better for contextualizing and explaining Thelema, except insofar as it's such an austere form that it takes.
And it's not all on this subject. This is just what we chose to read today. There are, you'll really cover.
It runs the Crowley, gamut,
You know, Crowley's school of thought from many perspectives as you work through this text slowly. And I think this was great. I think we should do more.
Yeah.
You know, not tomorrow, but let's pull another 8 chapters to choose 4 of.
Or to only get 4 of.
sometime later.
Sounds great. Well, thanks for joining me as usual, Michael.
Love is the law, love under will.
Love is the law, love under will. Thanks for listening. Look for Toronto Thelema on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Watch for events in the city. And join us again in the darkly splendid abodes. I did try to figure out base 40 briefly. No, I know you've lost interest completely. You just checked out. I watched you just check out entirely.
My forehead got itchy. I was just trying. I just had a scratch. I know. That's man. You'd be a great Scientologist. Apparently, what they do is you do a lot of self study in Scientology. So you all sit in a room together and you have the texts and you go through them. And if you see someone do that, if their eyes click away from the page and they scratch their forehead or something, you go to them and you say like, "So what didn't you understand?" And they're like, "What do you mean?" And they're like, "You had like a break. Like, what is it that you're confused about?" And they go like, "I don't know. What are you talking about?" And you're like, "Well, what were you reading just now? I guess this." And so then you have to look up every word in that paragraph in the Scientology dictionary, being like, "What does the mean? What does at mean?"
Well, you know, maybe it's a good thing to have Scientology around and prevalent because of the fact that gradually it gets all those insufferable people in one place. You don't have to deal with them.
Right, sure. a little club for the pedants.